You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, while nurses and hospital workers are often considered heroes, they're also vulnerable to violence. Government data shows that attacks against healthcare workers at hospitals have risen 60% since 2011. We'll look at what's behind the assaults and why more isn't being done to prevent them. Now, hospitals received the first doses of the long-awaited COVID-19 vaccine yesterday. Among the first people to be vaccinated were nurses, doctors, and other frontline healthcare workers. While healthcare workers cheered as their colleagues began receiving the shots, its rollout came as the United States passed a grim milestone. As of yesterday, the number of deaths associated with COVID-19 went over 300,000 in the United States. In Wisconsin, more than 4,000 people have died as a result of the disease. We'll hear stories about some of the Wisconsinites who have died from COVID-19 all through this week. Our next guest joins us to talk about the vaccine, its early rollout, and what you should know as more people get vaccinated. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the vaccine news? Do you plan on getting vaccinated once it's more widely available? If you're a healthcare worker, are you early on the list? What questions do you have about the vaccine, how it works, how things like this get distributed, and more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back.
Good to be back, Rob.
What are your thoughts on the early days of the rollout of the first of what's going to be a series of vaccines, Dr. Remington?
Well, we are in the very early days, and I'm really impressed with how fast the system has developed, not just the scientific research to bring the vaccine to market, but also the system to get it distributed. As you know, it's in the past, this is a process that's taken years, sometimes decades, to bring a vaccine to market. And we're seeing this happen in less than a year. So that's a real good news story.
What are some of the things that led to that relatively fast development of this vaccine?
Well, it builds on basic research that's been going on for many years. In fact, right here at the University of Wisconsin, some of the early research on messenger RNA was done to understand how cells can produce messenger RNA, but also how that might be used in a vaccine. So it's not like this was the first time somebody thought about creating a vaccine. All this basic science research had been done, so it was ready really to be put together. But it has been a tremendous partnership between the private sector and the government, not just in this country but worldwide, to really accelerate the process of scientific discovery right to implementation and putting the vaccine into individuals' arms.
Another head start seems to be being able to do a genetic map of a disease, which you couldn't do when you were developing a polio vaccine or a smallpox vaccine. China, for its missteps early on, I think people have credited with sharing a genetic profile of the virus pretty early on. Is that something that makes it a lot faster to get going on a vaccine?
There's no question that it does, because we need that information to be able to manufacture the vaccine, and having that fingerprint, so to speak, allowed the researchers to develop a vaccine much more rapidly than it would have been certainly back in the 1950s and 60s when the polio vaccine was coming to market.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the rollout of a vaccine for COVID-19. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Remington, there are national suggestions over the order in which people should get vaccines. I think the main decisions are left to the states. What do you think of what you're seeing so far in terms of the priority list?
Well, I think it's a good idea to think about those individuals who are at risk of becoming infected, and that would be our frontline healthcare workers. So that makes sense, not just because they're at risk of becoming infected, but also they would be at risk of transmitting the infection in the workplace. So given how hard they've worked and really putting their lives on the line, I think that makes great sense. And then the second group is those who are most likely to be harmed from getting infected, those living in long-term care facilities. We know that death rates among those infected can be in the 20 or 30% for people who are elderly and otherwise in a nursing home. So that group makes sense. And then the question is then, how do you go from those first priority groups then to the general population? And I think that'll be a process of each state considering how you balance the risk for the individual if they get sick and the importance of their job. If they're frontline workers or essential workers, then those should go before people who are able to stay at home, shelter in place, because their risk is quite low.
We've got the one vaccine rolled out now. There's a couple more knocking on the door in the approval process. Are we likely to see multiple vaccines out there available to the public in the few months to come?
Well, this actually happened in the rollout of the polio vaccine in the 1950s. There were two competing versions of polio vaccine. And over the years, actually, the preference shifted from the live attenuated polio vaccine to the killed vaccine. And I think that will happen here, but it's just at such a more accelerated rate. There are some challenges with the Pfizer vaccine in maintaining the cold chain, but there are advantages to being able to get that actually into place. So I think having more types of vaccine allow us to actually get more vaccine out and get back to business. I heard earlier in your radio show the challenges that restaurants and the hospitality industry have been facing, and that won't go away until we have a significant portion of the state immune through vaccination.
That's a key point there. We're not out of the woods yet. We've talked a lot about protecting ourselves from catching and transmitting COVID-19. Those rules don't go away in the few months to come, do they?
Oh, they certainly don't. Not in the months, and some may see not in the next few years. Because if you're at high risk of dying from this, if you're elderly or have a chronic illness, vaccines can reduce the risk, but they don't eliminate it. And outbreaks can still occur, especially if we don't have a high percentage of the population infected. So for many individuals, they will have to keep engaging in these safe practices, wearing masks, keeping socially distant. It's going to be a long time before the rate of transmission is low in communities. And this virus is not going to go away. This is like other viruses that have appeared. It will become endemic, but hopefully rare. And when it does occur, we can use the traditional public health methods of quarantine and isolation to stop it from being transmitted.
We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington right now, Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's with us to talk about the COVID-19 vaccine rollout that began yesterday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the vaccine and its early distribution? Will you get the vaccine when you are next in line? Do you want to wait for a while? What concerns do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine with Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the vaccine, its rollout, what it means for the months to come when it comes to the spread of COVID-19? What are you seeing in your community with the COVID-19 pandemic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Dr. Remington, now that people are getting this vaccine, what kind of oversight is there? What kind of things are we watching for as people get it, including, I guess, how long will it be effective?
Well, normally when vaccines are developed, there's a long period of studying where you enroll people in clinical trials. Some get the vaccine, some get a placebo. And during this time, you have a lot of people involved in the study. You can look for the potential side effects, those complications that are rare but and not serious. But what we're seeing now with the emergency use authorization from the FDA is that we have sufficient evidence to know that the vaccine is safe and effective, but we don't have a lot of experience with those side effects that can occur. And I'm sure your listeners have heard about some of those already that occur in people who've gotten early recipients of the vaccine. And what the FDA has in place is what's called post-marketing surveillance. And that is a ongoing surveillance system to monitor if there are any side effects. For example, in England, two individuals with significant allergies had reactions. And so that changed the recommendation for people with significant allergies to wait and to see what we can learn about the side effects for people with significant allergies. And so that will be important for the scientific community to be doing this surveillance and monitoring, to be looking for things that weren't apparent during the clinical trials because they might be very unusual, and then changing our recommendation moving forward.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bianca is with us in Madison. Bianca, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering about just very basic things. Does the mRNA go into all cells, or which cells is it going into, in addition to the immune response cells? And that the second part is, how long does the mRNA survive in the cells, and if there is any chance that it might, at some point, the spike protein would lodge into the cell surface and promote an immune reaction? Is there any likelihood of that in the future?
Bianca, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Remington, are those questions you've looked into?
Well, these questions involve basic biology. Many of us learned this in high school or college about how the DNA in the nucleus of the cell communicates with the rest of the cell and the cytoplasm and makes proteins. That's how our cells work. And that is through this messenger RNA. And by replicating that process, we're able to have our own cells produce that protein that SARS-CoV-2 has, that spike protein. And the good thing is that we've done a pretty good job of developing the technology to get our cells to produce that protein. And then the immune system recognizes it as foreign and begins to attack it. And so the evidence is that not only do those cells that produce that get attacked by our immune system, but that the messenger RNA then does not last. And so what you end up with is a lasting immunity in your immune cells to that spike protein, so that when later, if you are exposed to the real virus, your body already thinks that it's been infected and it's ready with the immune system to confront that virus and not let it cause serious illness.
Thanks a lot for that call, Bianca. We heard from Jeff, who couldn't stay on the line. He says he's already had COVID and is wondering if someone who's already had it would still need to be vaccinated, and if so, why?
Well, that's a great question. The recommendation right now is that if you've had COVID, either diagnosed with a antigen test or a PCR test, or you have antibodies, you should wait. You among the entire population, people who've had infection are at the lowest risk. But the evidence is that a vaccine can still help improve both the quality of the immunity at that time, but also perhaps the longevity of that immunity. We don't have a lot of experience providing vaccine to people who've been infected because the clinical trials have been done before these the big surge in cases. So I think that's a good question. The general recommendation is that those who've had infection probably have immunity, and that will be protective, but that, again, the vaccine would help those individuals. It's just don't be first in line. You can wait until the vaccine is widely available.
Let's go back to our callers. Lester is on the line in Milwaukee. Lester, hello.
Hey there, sir. How are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Lester?
Actually, with the issue of vaccines that are available across the world, we got China, we got Russia, we got the U.S. We have some very expensive drugs. We got a lot of poor countries around there that need vaccines. So is there really any strategies that can put in place to help these needy countries that need these types of antidotes?
Interesting, Lester. Thanks for the call. Dr. Remington, countries that don't have this kind of maybe infrastructure to produce their own vaccines and are maybe on the market to buy them.
Well, it's a great question. There was recently some media coverage about the fact that the developed nations in the world will be, in effect, clearing the shelves and taking what vaccine is available first. And I think that's unfortunate that we don't take a world view, that we think about how everybody in the world should be protected. I think how this will play out is that the first to get the vaccine will be in the developed nations with access to safe and effective vaccines. But pretty soon we're going to recognize that if we don't establish immunity worldwide, that we will be confronting outbreaks on an ongoing basis. We have a world economy. We have a connected globe in that people are traveling from country to country. And if the vaccine campaigns are not effective worldwide, then those countries that continue to see transmission will simply be the source of infection to countries that have benefited from the vaccine. So it is really, this is a global challenge, and the sooner we can help all countries in the world achieve widespread vaccination, the better.
Lester, thanks for the call. And Dr. Remington, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us today to talk about the COVID-19 vaccination rollout that started yesterday and what people should keep in mind as the vaccine becomes more widely available. The COVID-19 pandemic has claimed the lives of more than 4,000 people in Wisconsin. This week, as we approach the end of the year, WPR is profiling some of the people we lost. Today, Bridget Bowden tells us about Rosemary Kramer, who died in October.
Vicky Nicolas Ibarra has fond memories of growing up in Milwaukee, and her mother, Rosemary Kramer, was a big part of that.
When we were kids, after dinner, my parents would say, we need to wash the dishes. Or we could take the kids to the park. You know what? The dishes will still be here when we get back from the park, so they would take us.
Rosemary spent her life taking care of people. She took care of her husband, who lived with Parkinson's disease for 34 years. She took care of blood donors at Versity Blood Center, logging more than 2,500 volunteer hours and giving more than 30 gallons of blood herself. And she took care of her family, including her 8 great-grandchildren, who called her Gigi, short for great-grandmother.
She loved children so much, and they were drawn to her, absolutely drawn to her. I can't tell you how many kids have called her grandma that aren't her own.
In March, Rosemary's daughter Vicky left her home in Seattle to move in with her during lockdown. They spent the summer together in Milwaukee, with Vicky working from home. Then in mid-September, Vicky got sick. It started with a runny nose and then got worse. She got tested for COVID-19, and it came back positive.
I was devastated. I was terrified because now my mom didn't feel well. And she didn't even care that she didn't feel well. She was worried about me.
When Rosemary got tested, she was positive too. It was scary, but she managed to find a silver lining.
Even when my mom got the bad news about having COVID, her first thought was, I can't wait to survive this so I can donate my plasma to help other people.
Rosemary was given a pulse oximeter to monitor the oxygen in her blood from home. Eventually, it dropped very low, and she needed to go to the hospital. Since Vicky was sick, another family member came to drive her there.
As my mom stood at the door, she turned back to me and said, "All I wanted to do was just hug you. But because the health department told us we shouldn't, she wouldn't, even though she knew she was leaving. My heart aches for her thinking about that. Why didn't I just hug her one last time?"
The weeks Rosemary spent in the hospital were full of ups and downs. One day, she could barely breathe. The next day, she was alert and talking. Eventually, though, she got tired, and she knew she didn't have much longer. She called all of her family members to say goodbye. As Rosemary was taken off of life support, the family asked hospital staff to play familiar music.
One of her favorite artists was John Denver, because my mom loved the beauty of nature and simple things, and he sang about how beautiful the world is, and he told such beautiful stories in his songs. And we asked, when she passed away, for the nurse to please play Annie's Song by John Denver, and he did. And so that brought us some comfort, because she just loved that.
Rosemary Kramer died on October 14th at age 74. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow we bring you the story of six nuns from a convent in Greenfield who are educators and caretakers, artists, and musicians. Coming up, we'll take a look at concerns about increasing violence against healthcare workers in the United States, including facilities here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the campaign to tackle AIDS and HIV can tell us a lot about why some protests work and others don't. Jen White teams up with Radiolab to dig deeper into that story. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, it hasn't got a lot of attention, but violence against nurses and hospital workers has been climbing steadily over the years. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics says since 2011, there's been a 60% increase in the rate of attacks against healthcare workers. It also says the risk of being injured by violence is five times greater for healthcare workers than employees in any other private sector industry. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, medical facilities that are often flush with cash are failing to address the problem. The findings are detailed in their ongoing series called In the Shadows. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a doctor, nurse, or other hospital worker? How worried are you about the risk of being physically attacked while at the workplace? Has an uptick in violence caused you to reconsider a career at a medical facility? What kind of safety and security changes have been made or would you like to see made? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Raquel Rutledge and John Diedrich are investigative reporters at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Raquel, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And John, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having us.
Raquel, I mentioned just a couple of the statistics there. Can you talk more about how sadly common these kind of attacks against hospital workers can be?
Well, you know, as you said, it is healthcare workers are 5 times more likely to get assaulted while at work than any other. I mean, they're right up there, actually, with police officers and security guards that are public sector workers. But yeah, it's surprising to me. It's one of those things that I guess if you're in the industry, if you work as a nurse or a doctor and you're living it every day, or you have family members who are, you might not be as surprised. But from someone who, you know, kind of coming from the outside, it's very shocking. I mean, and it started with the death of Carly Bowden in Milwaukee, who was leaving her job, you know, at 1 o'clock in the morning and was attacked by somebody who had been hanging out around the hospital for 2.5 hours and was undetected by security. So that's what got us looking into this in the first place.
And John, another story you focused on, you talked to a nurse at a Frederick Hospital in Wauwatosa, attacked during the summer while checking on a patient. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah, that's right. We had a nurse who was checking out a patient, a 24-year-old woman who came in to do what she typically does and was sexually assaulted by this patient. And the thing about the attack, as shocking as it was and that how common these are, was the response from the hospital, from Frederick, just in terms of how they investigated or, you know, failed to act quickly would be more appropriate. And just in terms of the follow-up and the lack of response. And in terms of this isn't just a Frederick issue, we're seeing this across the country where these attacks happen. And nurses and doctors are really out on the edge. People that we're counting on in the pandemic, as we're all aware, and they've been subjected to this for a long time. And hospitals, in that case and others, failed to investigate and failed to take actions, really, most importantly, to prevent these.
And the stories you both just shared involve common sites of attack for healthcare workers. And Raquel, let's start with the one you shared about parking garages. This is not unique. You point out in your piece on this that you have staff doing shifts that bring them out of their shifts at all or into all hours of the day. Talk about this parking garage at health facility risk.
Yeah, well, when we first wrote the story about Carly Bowden getting beaten to death out in the parking garage, we got hundreds, I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of responses from healthcare workers around the world who said they face the same thing, which is that they're, you know, they're often forced to park in faraway lots and they're very dimly lit oftentimes. And they don't have security guards out there. Often they're empty lots that don't have proper cameras. And a lot of times, you know, people think when they see the cameras that, oh, there's somebody behind the screen monitoring. So it kind of gives you a false sense of security, because what we found is that for the most part, those cameras are not monitored in real time. So, for example, in the case of Carly Bowden, the attack on her lasted for 6 minutes. I mean, she was just brutally beaten to death, and that whole thing was on camera. But there was nobody monitoring the cameras. So these parking garages have proven to be, over the decades, we interviewed a woman from Chicago who was walking after her shift back to her car and got held up at knife point, thrown in her car, raped in her car, and then thrown into her trunk, and was locked in her trunk for 9 hours before being noticed by somebody. She was screaming in the back when the next shift came in the next morning. So, and that was in the 1970s. So we've interviewed people over the decades, and this problem just continues.
We are talking about risks of assault faced by healthcare workers at hospitals. Raquel Rutledge and John Diedrich with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They have an ongoing series on that issue. John, Raquel just talked about parking structures. Talk about your story illustrated the risk that a nurse, say, or other healthcare provider might face dealing with patients one-on-one. How common is that kind of attack?
Well, if you look again at the number of attacks, it's just astonishing. We referenced the number at the beginning, but this is a risk area that I had no idea how at risk health workers are, and that these attacks happen. We spoke to one nurse at a ER in Massachusetts, and he said typically 5 to 6 times per shift, somebody on the staff, on the ER staff, is being assaulted in some way. I documented the story and spoke to Jessica Rosen. She was an ICU nurse at St. Luke's in Milwaukee. And what she shows, what she demonstrates and her story demonstrates, is that this doesn't just happen in the ER. She was attacked by a patient and a syringe was taken out of her hand and put to her neck by this patient. and her shoulder was wrenched. And as it turns out, that particular injury drove her from nursing. She felt like she could no longer safely be in nursing. And she became an advocate, really, and just started to become a clearinghouse, if you will, for other nurses telling her about what was happening. The level of violence was just astonishing. And I think if you just look at the number of stories, and we continue to see just huge numbers of stories and people sending us, we had a collage. It's difficult to look at. I'll just warn people, but it's of all these injuries that nurses and other health workers have suffered across the country. And there are many more stories that we continue to hear. But sadly, it's a very, very common phenomenon where nurses and health workers are attacked, both physically and verbally, by patients and their families.
In your piece, Raquel, the two of you and your colleagues lay out the problems, but also point out there are a lot of potential solutions out there. Let's start with some of the security issues you raised in the parking ramps and elsewhere. What kind of changes do security experts say can make a big difference for those kind of attacks?
Well, in the parking areas, the big things are lighting, you know, having adequate lighting. We went out and tested, we hired a consultant to come in from Florida and test some of the hospital parking garages around Milwaukee. And he found that every single one of them had, serious security shortcomings. And one of the things is lighting. So lighting, dimly lit places are definitely, can harbor people that are up to no good. And so lighting's one. Cameras, actually having them monitored or having sophisticated software for cameras that can sort of detect folks that are, acting erratically. That could help. Escorts out. One of the things we heard from nurses around the world, really, is that, the hospitals will say, well, we have an escort program and we can walk people to their cars or we can shuttle you to your car. But what we found time and time again is that they're not efficient. They're not practical. Like, actually, if you do want an escort out to your car, oftentimes you have to wait 20 or 30 minutes. And after you've been working for 12 hours, these nurses and others are tired and they don't want to be waiting in the middle of the night for 20 or 30 minutes to get a ride to their car. So often they just risk it. So having actually feasible type escort programs can be helpful. Putting actual alarms that work on your badges that are connected to a real live person that can locate where you are if you have an emergency. Those things help. So for parking, those are the big ones.
And John, another commonly raised concern for those attacks inside a clinic, a hospital, short staffing. What kind of things did you hear from people?
Well, this is actually the way hospitals have been operating for a long time. And this is, as they looked at the sort of like just-in-time staffing, just enough staffing to get by. So there's different phrases for it. But this level of staffing that hospitals have built into the system to, to put it no other way, to maximize profits on certain procedures, what that does is put nurses and other workers at risk, because simply sometimes the numbers, it's a number situation. The gentleman that the nurse that I was telling you about from Massachusetts, he's describing attacks 5 or 6 times a shift, and literally being outnumbered, in an attack or outmanned, if you will, where he was really felt like he was possibly fighting for his life, and that he had a very hostile patient who was trying to potentially. He was getting in a fight where he potentially could have disarmed an armed police officer who was there. So when we're looking at that, those numbers make a big difference. And just in terms of that's a big one that nurses told us that they said just coming into a room and just being alone with a patient. If that patient, if there is any indication that patient has been violent in the past, another shortcoming, the lack of that kind of warning system. But with that warning, if you don't have the staff to come in, it doesn't really matter. But if you have additional staff to help, it makes a huge difference.
Well, and just to back that up a little bit, the studies do show. So, for example, California put a cap on the patient to staff ratio. And in the 5 years following that, studies show that it decreased overall violence in hospitals by 30%. Overall injuries to nurses, let me be clear on that. Actually, overall injuries went down. Studies have shown even back as far as 1999 that show that when you have a higher level of staff to patient ratio, that the violence does decrease. So it's proven to be effective.
We're talking about a rise in violence against nurses and other hospital workers with Raquel Rutledge and John Dietrich, investigative reporters with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They've been writing about the problem and solutions that are out there. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in healthcare, is this a concern for you about your safety while on the job? What could your workplace do to make you feel more safe? Have you seen new security measures, safety measures in the clinic or hospital where you work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel series called In the Shadows, looking at the rise in violence against nurses and other hospital workers and the failure by facilities nationwide to tackle the problem. Investigative reporters Raquel Rutledge and John Diedrich stay with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions for our guest or a personal experience or observation to share from maybe working at a hospital yourself. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Raquel, I guess a basic question here. Why do we see healthcare workers so disproportionately targeted by violent attacks?
Well, I mean, they're dealing with a clientele that oftentimes is under, you know, major stress. They're dealing with people that have alcohol and substance use disorders, mental health disorders, people that are just under a large amount of stress, violence. Some people are coming in either violently ill or, you know, are victims of violence, and the violence sometimes spills over and follows them in. So they're dealing with, you know, unusual circumstances that the rest of us don't face. And so that's where, you know, that's where they need this added protection, because it isn't like most other places. They're open to the public basically 24/7. And so you get all sorts of people coming in at all hours.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tim is on the line in Middleton. Tim, hello.
Hi. I had some questions for the investigative reporters. As a nurse myself, I've been attacked in ICUs and ERs throughout my career. And I was wondering if they were thinking about it, doing anything like what the U.S. military is doing now, where instead of having them do internal investigations, they're actually starting to call the actual police to do the investigation rather than the internal. And if they've been bringing up any of the issues with OSHA for not providing safe workplaces. Nothing like coming off the air.
Yeah, I mean, those are great questions. As far as calling the outside police, I mean, they do that. But what we heard time and time again is that their employers often discourage that. They discourage them from reporting it. It's sort of the culture is, you know, it's just part of the job. It just happens. We just accept it and move on. And so there's a bit of a pressure and a culture to not report these crimes. And then secondly, as far as OSHA goes, that was one of our findings in our original story, was that, you know, OSHA does very little in terms of this. There is a bill pending. It's stalled out in the Senate that was passed last November. And it would require OSHA to have a standard, a mandate that would require healthcare facilities to have workplace violence prevention programs, because that is not the case right now. So, but that has, like I said, it's been stalled for months now. So I spoke with one of the senators from Wisconsin who said that she will be reintroducing it or re-pushing for that at this next session.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. And John, can you talk some more about, you write about these are sometimes healthcare systems with a fair amount of money not making investments in even the simpler security solutions. Why are we seeing that?
Well, if you talk to security consultants, as we did, a number of them, they said, you know, they look at security as being overhead. They don't look at it as being, and it was an interesting comment from Tom Smith, who's been doing this for more than 20 years out of North Carolina. He said when he comes in, he tells the health executives that, you know, I'm going to find all these problems. And that's huge. If you had, you know, like medical equipment, like respirators failing and things like that, you know, that would be a critical issue. But routinely, you're seeing things like as Raquel mentioned, you know, the panic buttons or the monitors not being kept up, or, you know, lighting being insufficient. And then inside, one of the big things that's been discussed is metal detectors, that those have a huge deterrent effect. They catch a surprising number. I guess it's not surprising when you think, as Raquel just mentioned, who's coming into hospitals. Yet a lot of hospitals have resisted this. It's a very small percentage of hospitals that have metal detectors. And part of that comes back to the public relations image consciousness. But when you look at the dollars, as we did, we're talking about multi-millions of dollars in cash that hospitals are sitting on. In some cases, the very large systems, even more than that, hundreds of millions or even more in the largest. That's a ton of money. And a lot of that money is invested in things like infrastructure. That's more about, consumer satisfaction or patient satisfaction, like the foyer and things like this, fine art, literally having, fine china there. And I think hospital workers are rightly asking, where's the priority? What about our safety and some things that are really not that costly that could really protect people?
Talking to John Diedrich and Raquel Rutledge from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about their series In the Shadows on the risks of assault faced by healthcare workers. Let's bring on another caller now. Kathy is with us in Madison. Kathy, hello.
Why, hello. This was back in 83, but my sister went to be an RN, and her last rotation, she went over 3.5 years. I mean, she's really close to being an RN. She had to do her final rotation in the psych ward, and she's, packed, and she's only 5'3" and 120 pounds, so she's attacked every day, and she almost quit nursing school. So my three older brothers offered to go up there and take her, be with her when, and she had to take a rotation. But we have a shortage of nurses, so if it hasn't changed, something to really look at strongly, because she went on to be a nurse, but she really came close to quitting. So
I just want. Thanks for sharing your sister's story. Raquel, is this something you're seeing keep people out of healthcare professions or driving them out?
I think it is more driving them out than it is keeping them out, because the folks that we spoke to and the people that teach nursing school, we did speak to one woman who teaches this in her class and says, like, hey, I tell my students the violence they're going to face, and they're just shocked and they can't believe it. But I've interviewed dozens and dozens of people for this investigation, and by and large, most of the people say it hasn't been taught to them. They weren't expecting it coming in, and so they're not prepared for it. And absolutely. The one person that we spoke to in Massachusetts that was injured in August with his arm got twisted in the stretcher of a patient who was on PCP, and it was kicking and kicking, and his arm got jammed in the side rail of the stretcher, and I mean, just tore a muscle, bruised as it could be, and he wasn't even healed, but he came back to work because it was difficult to pay his bills on workers' comp, and so he came back to work, and that's when he encountered somebody who had a criminal who was coming in, and they weren't forewarned about this criminal who, like, his background at all, and the guy had been indicted on rape charges and had beaten up his father the day before and beaten the family dog. And just, he was a very violent individual. And that person picked up a metal chair and hit him with a metal chair. And I mean, he just said, you know, he's 42 and he has two children. And, you know, sometimes he worries that he's not going to go home at the end of the day. So definitely. He said not one person he works with in the emergency room feels safe coming to work.
John, in our last few moments, is there any sense that these problems are coming out of the shadows? I mean, everybody in healthcare seems to know about them, but not a lot being done about them. Do you get a sense that there's a change in the works?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the things that's being discussed right now, just through, social media and so forth, is that people are coming forth. There's a movement on some of the comments that were posted on this were called Silent No More. And that phrase, as we've seen it show up at various places, is being applied now to this idea of quietly enduring this. Health workers are being, encouraged to step out and say more. And just based on the reaction that we're hearing, I think more and more workers are saying we really need to do something. And I think, you know, we are seeing the public becoming aware. People are shocked and surprised. That's been the response that we've had. But that it's, there are a lot of forces at play here. And I think a lot would need to happen and be known for these things to change. But I think we are seeing that increased awareness.
We'll leave it there. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Raquel, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for the interest in the story.
We've been talking to Raquel Rutledge and John Diedrich, investigative reporters at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to them about their ongoing series. It's called In the Shadows. It's about the growing violence against nurses and hospital workers around the nation and possible solutions to that problem.